Well, thanks for the opportunity to show you some of the research that we're doing at the Danforth Center in St. Louis. Just some quick background on what the Danforth Center is. We are the largest independent nonprofit research institute in the world, dedicated exclusively to plant biology. I certainly don't need to tell you folks why plant biology is important. That's usually sort of the pub talk stuff I get into. But we have a wide range of research interests, and we're doing a lot of the research that is often not commercially convenient or rewarding, but is nonetheless crucial for our survival. We're all familiar with the Green Revolution in the 50s and 60s, and the breeding that was extraordinarily effective, looking at dwarfing of small grains, wheat and rice, using hybrid technology in maize and fertilizers, pesticides, water irrigation, everything to work with above-ground traits, things that we can look at and measure. Obviously, one of the most important components of the plant here is missing. There are no roots. They're inconveniently out of the way and difficult to measure, but they're crucial for plant biology. You need to have roots. They do everything. They pull in nutrients, water. They secure the soil. They sequester carbon. There's a very, very long list, but how do you breed for something you can't measure? Measurement is a huge component. Even subtle measurements can be very accurately determined using multivariate statistics and large populations. So population genetics, quantitative genetics, it's a huge component of modern breeding. How do we apply these tools to root biology? And there are a wide range of traits that are incredibly important. Nitrogen use efficiency, water, drought tolerance, acclimatization to different soil types. Root biology is a huge component that we need to be breeding for, and measuring these components of root biology is really a lot of what we're after at the Danforth Center. Roots are notoriously difficult to get at. There's a lot going on. There's a lot going on below the surface, and various anecdotal references about 1 meter of soil has more microorganisms than any other location on the planet, and I don't know how quite accurate that is, but it's certainly thought-provoking, and I expect it is one of the most complex ecosystems on the planet, simply because of the number of variables that occur in every single interaction between plant, microbes, soil, water, oxygen, everything else. So measuring roots in a meaningful way in an artificial system really never captures full phenotypic reality. So on the left-hand side, phenotypic reality is all the roots. How close can we get to phenotypic reality? You can dig out trenches, which can show you a lot, but for maybe one or two plants. You can do a soil core, which, again, soil cores, many rhizotrons, they only capture small components. The lab I'm in at the Danforth Center, we've been doing root crown excavations for numerous years because you can get very good 2D data and over large populations. So we will do extensive shovelomics experiments that we will go out and literally dig thousands of maize root crowns, just that one nexus of where all the roots have met. And there's a lot of trait information you can get from there. And we had a mobile 2D station that we could do simple 2D imaging. And there are a lot of root traits that we could, in fact, measure. They were relatively meaningful, and they would correlate with actual biology, actual root performance. But 2D imaging is obviously limited. So we've been using X-ray tomography for the past 3 years to look at much more sophisticated traits in root systems. So a quick summary of what we're using this large instrument for. You have an X-ray source, you have a sample, and a detector. The source will project X-rays through the sample, generating a digital radiograph. That's not an optical slice. That is, in fact, the entire structure with all visible components compressed into one. And you generate an image based on variation in sample density. That sample will rotate over 360 degrees, and we'll collect thousands of images. And we'll collect all thousands of those thousands of images. We'll use the computer to generate a 3D volume that can now be digitally dissected. So this pepper was, in fact, completely intact, but we can now study and therefore measure every internal component that our computer scientists can identify. So we could count the seeds, we could measure the seeds, we could map the distribution. We now have access to sophisticated measurement tools for traits. Obviously, we're not doing a whole lot of work with pepper, but this is a very good way to illustrate what sort of non-destructive imaging is about. I mentioned excavated root crowns. A single 3-minute scan will now give you a really sophisticated 3D volume that can be measured in dozens and dozens of ways. So now our challenge is to determine what traits are biologically relevant. How many root angles is it important to measure? Root depth, root width, different shapes. Over thousands of root crowns from a population, there's going to be tremendous power in the statistics to actually differentiate between genotypes. We have a PhD student who's done just that. And these are some examples of the various types of measurements that a 3D volume can provide. And in fact, using linear discriminant analysis, he's able to actually consistently and accurately separate genotypes based on some of the 3D features that we can measure. So we've established that we can measure in challenging enough ways that we can separate genotypes. So we can start to do root-based breeding. Excavated root crowns are relatively simple. You just have the root crown and air. There's nothing else there. It's easy to see. If you're looking at roots in soil, it's profoundly more difficult. So on the left-hand side, you're looking at a top-to-bottom view through an artificial growing medium. The small blue components are what our computer scientists have identified as roots. And on the right-hand side, that resulting root structure has been projected. This is a very challenging operation. These are 5 separate digital radiographs of roots growing in a range of growth media. They're very, very difficult to see because roots are, in terms of density and X-ray, very, very similar to everything around it. So how do you coach a computer? How do you teach a computer to find where all the roots are? Part of that is interns, REU students, undergrads, literally going through an Wacom tablet and identifying slice by slice, identifying roots. We were burning through interns at a frightful rate, and it really was not effective. So what we were able to do is take those data and start to use convolutional neural networks. It's a form of artificial intelligence and deep learning to coach and train computer systems to identify what is and is not a root. Because we can't measure the roots until we can isolate the roots from everything else. X-rays are dumb. They'll show you the root and the soil and the air and the pot and the water and everything else, and they won't tell you what's the important part. That's the computational side. So Ni Jiang is a postdoc in our lab, and she is really skilled with designing convolutional neural networks and using trained data sets to then look at a naive data set and come up with really quite elegant 3D volumes with a for dramatic effect.
Not expect that to happen.
I thought it was supposed to have thunder and lightning. But you get a very effective 3D volume to work with. But we do run up against a resolution limit. So the other instrument we have, in addition to the large-scale, large-format instrument, is we have an X-ray microscope. And as it turns out, I'm not proud, I'm going to brag, this is the only X-ray microscope on the planet that is located at a plant science institute. There's numerous instruments around at engineering schools and medical schools and geology buildings and private industry. But to have 24/7 access to an X-ray microscope, I now have the luxury of playing and learning how to sort of leverage my electron microscope background into generating contrast in plant samples and start to see things in 3D that we've never seen before. So the X-ray microscope is a little different. Rather than just projecting X-rays through a sample onto a detector, the X-rays are projected onto the front of an objective lens. That lens has a coating which converts the X-rays into light. The lens now magnifies that to your detector, so you get much, much higher resolution. Your trade-off is sample size. To get higher resolution, just like any form of imaging, higher resolution, smaller sample. But between the two instruments, we can really have great overlap and see a lot of different things. So the image on the top left with the red box is a soybean floret. It's a very complicated structure. There are male and female parts, and to measure them would be a great feat. So in the X-ray microscope, one single floret complex properly contrasted will give you this level of resolution and detail. The individual dots are pollen nuclei, so we now have access to biological features that that we can measure in near electron microscope resolution. But keep in mind, it's a 3D volume. It's not just one single slice through plastic or wax. We have the full 3D volume. So we have access now to some biological measurements that are really unique. We're very interested in brace root formation in maize, so we can look at relatively low magnification and just highlight the vasculature. Again, now that we have a map of the vasculature, we have computer scientists who can now measure this and map this. And now if you compare many different varieties, you can start to get a handle on trait variation relative to some of these important features. We can keep upping the magnification. This is a single brace root primordium. And again, the vasculature is much more dense than the surrounding tissue. Any difference in density that we can find is a tool or a handle for our computer scientists to map and evaluate. Again, measurement will now lead us to trait identification. Trait identification leads us to genes responsible for these traits. And that's the ultimate goal. Can we identify genes for favorable traits to get out into the breeding population? We can look at individual maize root tips. This is a particularly interesting project to work out what are good contrasting conditions, because we can now identify individual cells in the elongation and meristematic zones. Roots only do three things. They will divide, they will lengthen, and they will branch. Nothing else. But you end up with tens of thousands of roots from a single corn plant. So what are the decisions that are made, and what's governing those decisions and how roots behave? Interactions with soil fungi. That's a really important component of root biology. So we're looking at mycorrhizal fungi. They form arbuscules, or the feeding or transfer structures, these large structures here with the red box. They will provide phosphorus and water to the plant roots in exchange for carbon in the form of photosynthate or sugar. That interchange is very, very important. And so to what degree can we use X-ray microscopy to actually look at this interaction in 3D? On the left in the single red box is one arbuscule, and on the right is an animation through a 3D volume where we see numerous arbuscules through the root cortex. If I can generate a good enough scan, then our computer scientists can then map all the arbuscules as long as they can differentiate the fungal structures from the plant structures. Again, the first step to measurement, the first step to trait identification is measurement of desirable traits. Contrasting these samples is very important. We're now looking into quantum dots and nanogold. Can we use those as basic contrast agents as well as agents of localization? Can we have these very dense structures go to regions of interest? And we can look across scales. Using the large-scale instrument, we can scan the soybean plant, as I showed you earlier. The middle image there is the segmented or computer science separated root structure with individual nodules formed by nitrogen-fixing bacteria. And then if I remove one of those nodules and image that with the X-ray microscope, again, we can get down to cellular level resolution. So imaging across scales. Further with that, if we take one of those nodules, embed it in resin, we can go to some colleagues at Washington University in St. Louis who have a nano-SIMS instrument. This is a secondary ion mass spec. It will essentially raster an ion beam across your sample, and the molecules that are ablated will be sucked through a mass spec. And if it's programmed properly, you can identify individual elements and their deposition within the sample. So we can localize nitrogen and carbon in this structure used for nitrogen exchange for plants. We're doing PET imaging at the medical school at Washington University. It's actually the first medical system in the U.S. to do human PET imaging. That is positron emission tomography. It's a short-lived isotope. Carbon is what we're using, and we can deliver radioactive carbon in CO2 to leaves, and within 90 minutes, we can see the movement of CO2 as that's converted to sugar and then mobilized into roots. This is an imaging setup, or the setup of the imaging system at WashU. They actually have one of the only PET imaging detector systems set up inside a plant growth chamber. So on the right, there's a clamp which will deliver CO2, radioactive CO2 gas to maize leaves. And again, within 90 minutes, you will see deposition and movement of CO2 into roots. We've been doing this with soybean, with maize, and with alfalfa. The animation for the alfalfa is a little slow, but one of the difficulties, and I'll get to that sort of in the summary, is multimodal data sets. How can you work with different forms of data, different types of data sizes, as well as resolutions, and get them to co-register? It's a very challenging issue. But to wrap up, some of the really promising aspects of this type of work is we generate 3D volumes, which are significantly more informative than 2D imaging, but from a meter down to nanometer resolution, so really working across scales. We're using this to look directly at root microbe interactions, and specifically to look at nutrient flux, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, across time and scales. I probably said computer scientists and computer postdocs at least a dozen times. They are the brains behind the operation. I do the imaging, that's easy. Without sophisticated computer scientists and hardware and software, you can't pull biology back out the other end of this scan data. There's always the question of translating lab and greenhouse work to field data. We want to get closer and closer to authentic field situations, so how can we do that but still be able to accurately measure? And always, again, the trade-off between sample size and resolution. One great big corn plant, you can get 100 micrometer resolution, but you're limited. Where we want to go in the future is using VR and AR. Can we combine VR with our segmentation software? So rather than typing on a flat panel, can we put on the goggles and literally hold on to the roots that we want to use, link that to a segmentation algorithm, and much more rapidly segment out root systems? So Top Lab is very sophisticated. We try to image our root systems on the floor of the Danforth Center. We have a tremendous support staff, great REU students, technicians, postdocs, and facilities, and we're supported by the funding organizations and companies on the right-hand side. Just about 18 minutes, maybe one question? Time for one question? Yes?
Yeah, it's difficult to pick one
question. The discussion later.
So I'll just jump into the one most related to looking at the rhizosphere biology. So right at the end, you were watching the flow of newly assimilated CO2 into different parts, but to what extent can you watch the flow out of the root feeding the rhizosphere?
Oh, that's a great question. The question was, how can we look at movement of CO2 using PET imaging, not only into the roots, but also into the rhizosphere? And we are, in fact, doing that. One of the challenges is the difference in scale. PET imaging gives you about 3 to 4 millimeters resolution. But what we're doing is, alfalfa is a great system for this, because the mycorrhizal fungi will form a network of hyphae out into the growing medium. So we can very accurately use X-ray imaging to identify where the roots are. We can follow where the PET signal is going, and then by overlaying the two, we can identify where it leaves those roots. Now, there's a time limitation. The half-life of the radioactive carbon is just 20 minutes. So dosing it with 10 millicuries, you get about almost 2 hours of imaging. But in that time, there is significant movement beyond the level of the roots. It's just difficult to map that accurately. But we can say, yes, it's outside.
Thank you, Keith. So after the four speakers, you know, we will have a panel discussion. So if you have more questions for Keith, you can ask it at that time. Those of you who want to ask questions of the speakers, now is your opportunity.
I have a question regarding the scion apple. Is there an influence of the soil type on the type of compounds they release? For example, if the apple is in a sandy site versus a clay, is there a difference in the type of?
That's a really good question that I don't have an answer to.
Oh, yes.
The question was whether the soil type influences the apple metabolites that we're studying. And I have an idea of a system where we could try to study that, but we haven't studied that extensively. I'm assuming it would to some extent. Whether or not it's easy to detect with the systems we're using, that's another question. I mean, I feel like the system we're using is kind of a macro scale assessment at this point.
Mm-hmm. twist on that question.
Yes.
How about this sort of microbiome on the apple, on the rootstock, tablet?
So the question is how the soil microbiome influences the root exudates? Yeah, I imagine that is true too. Again, it's the same problem where we're trying to assess something like that in a very precise scale. It's just technically challenging. One way that I've thought about trying to look at that, and I've seen other study do it, is something where you'd use C13 carbon, CO2, so you'd use carbon with C13 in it, so heavy isotope carbon, and then put the plant in that environment, and then it would translocate compounds that it's making in the leaves down into the root system, and then you'd have the metabolites produced by the tree that have heavy isotope carbon in them, so you could analyze those and see which ones are from the tree, and then you could track that into the microbes and into the microbial metabolite system as well. But that's technically challenging, and I just moved to a lab where I'm making a lab out of a 100-year-old house in western Montana. So it'll be, I'm intending to work with my former colleagues at the USDA and with ARS and Wenatchee, where they have LC-MS QTOF that can maybe do that kind of work, but it just will take longer at this point. Good question, though, and good thoughts, for sure. Thank you.
Yeah, so the Sudan grass, the question was whether biochar and the cover, how it affected the yield. Basically the cover crops didn't have much of an effect on marketable yield, although Sudan grass did lower the marketable yield of the Sudan mango trees. So I showed a picture of the plots early on in my presentation, and you can see that the Sudan grass was fairly tall, and sometimes basically right before harvest it would actually kind of tower over the mango trees and cause some shading. So I think it was benefit, and it was good and bad, because it did seem to reduce the unmarketable yield, but it also lowered the yield overall. So I think it was providing some kind of shade to the trees and reducing the sunburn that they got. So a lot of the unmarketable yield was actually due to just sunburn. So I think that Sudan grass kind of helped to mitigate that, but also just lowered the yield overall.
Did you try different rates of biochar, or just was the same amount?
Not for this study, no. The question is whether we tried different rates of biochar, and for this study it was uniform. So it was about 1.8 tons to the acre. In different studies, I've tried using different rates of biochar. Most of the time, biochar seems to increase. I look at nitrogen-fixing bacteria specifically, so with legumes, and most of the time it seems to increase nodulation and nitrogen fixation in legumes. But there's not really, as far as I can tell, there's no like cutoff point for where it becomes maybe negative. Yeah.
What was the source of the biochar? Was it
a
hardwood-based biochar?
The source of the biochar came from a company called Cool Planet, which is based in California, and they generally make a coconut shell biochar. Yeah, this was...
Completely distinct
So the comment is that the work that they've done, and I read your paper, and it made me nervous, and I'll tell you why. The comment is that both the rootstock and the scion can have an endophytic microbiome present in it, and then the rootstock can actually influence the scion microbiome. Am I correct to say that?
Say that again.
The rootstock endophytic microbiome can influence the scion
right.
endophytic microbiome. I read that paper, maybe your paper, one very similar. I got to thinking about the fact that we were tissue culturing apple rootstocks, and there's no step where I was trying to eliminate endophytes in them. And so I went ahead and tested that, and there are indeed endophytes still in my tissue culture rootstocks. And I can't even begin to think about what that is doing to the exudate metabolome that I'm studying. I mean, I can plate out the exudates. I mean, the exudates are being collected in water. You probably saw my little tissue culture box. I can plate them out and not get any colony-forming units. But I can test the plant and then still find endophytes inside the plant. And that's deeply troubling. Yeah. I'm not sure if that answered your question, though. What was your question again? Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering if you had actually gone back to look at what the pedigree is of those different cultivars.
Yeah, so the question is if...
There's this concept about you know, how the microbiome has evolved with the genotype. And so I'm curious about that.
Yeah, so the question is if the pedigree might be influencing the root exudate microbiome. And I haven't taken apart the data to that level yet, and I don't think we have sufficient data to really establish a clear relationship at this time. But I think that'd be a very interesting question to ask. Mm-hmm.
More questions? Yes.
So I have a question for Rachel regarding your methodology for collecting the root exudate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how does that reflect the real condition in the soil system?
Yeah, so the question is if collecting the root exudates really reflects what's happening in the soil system. I 100% agree with you. It doesn't. That's kind of what you're implying. And that's why the initial experiment I set up, I was trying to use rootstocks that a grower might use, like the kind of 3/8 or 5/8 inch caliper rootstocks an apple grower might plant in the field. It was in a greenhouse system, so you know, not exactly outside, but a more controlled environment. But that first project that I did, we ran into the problems where it's difficult to separate microbes living from the roots from metabolites and try to find out what the metabolites are that are being produced. And that was my initial goal. So then we moved into that more tissue culture-based system where the trees are being grown in little tiny sterile conditions. And I agree that doesn't totally reflect what a tree would be like in a field condition. It's the best we can do at this moment to have some initial data on what metabolites are being produced by apple root systems. Like I said, there are maybe methods like the C13 isotope labeling that you can maybe use more in a field setting, but that requires some expensive equipment that not everybody has access to. Does that answer your question? Do you have any follow-up questions? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the question is if the compounds we identified could be applied to a real soil situation and then have some impacts. Actually, the people back at the USD where I was working, another postdoc is taking that approach. They're applying, so we have a suite of metabolites that we found in the soil. We kind of know their amounts and relative levels. We can sort of make a synthetic root exudate metabolite profile and apply that if you want, or assess like one microbe or one metabolite at a time in conjunction with the soil system. It's no system for analyzing it is perfect. And each project you do leads to more questions. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a question on the high resolution X-ray. Thinking about the possibilities for that. And one of the processes for establishing the root microbiome has been that process where you have the border cells coming off, coming out, the soil sheet forming, that whole consortium of microbes that gets into there and develops in the rhizosphere of the growing root, how suited is the high-res X-ray for
So if I understand the question, what is the utility of some of the high-resolution X-ray imaging systems for looking at the development of the root sheath, really, that microbiome right in the direct vicinity of the root? Is that close? Yeah, no, that's a great question, and in fact, that's one of the things we're very interested in. First is working out the imaging conditions. Again, there's always the trade-off between the resolution you need and how big a sample you can use. But the X-ray microscope, in many respects, is like a tabletop synchrotron. But rather than getting a 10-minute scan, it's 20 hours. But in that time, anywhere from... We're growing alfalfa, especially, is very useful because you can grow it in very tall, narrow pots. And those are ideal geometries for doing X-ray imaging because you want to, in X-ray imaging, get your sample as close to the detector and the source as possible. And so what we're doing with that is looking at, again, alfalfa growing in a range of media from pure sand all the way through to field soil, and trying to identify what else can we see apart from the roots. And there was one image I showed very quickly of looking at the mycorrhizal fungi in a microfuge tube. And we'd use the nano dots and the quantum dots and the nano gold to contrast them. What that allowed us to do was to actually visualize spores and realize what size we're looking for, and that helps us gauge the instrument to say, all right, if we need to see something of this specific resolution, what energies, what geometries are we likely needing? So I guess that's the long answer to we're in the middle of doing that, and it's a crucial question, because once we can confirm that we're seeing X root fungal structures outside of roots, especially spores, I don't think we'll see hyphae. I think they're just too non-dense in a living system, in vivo. But I expect we can see spores in vivo and, in fact, trace these over time. But then combining that with PET imaging, we can start to literally scan that one pot and then the next day take it to WashU for PET imaging and then overlay those data sets. So we know where the roots are. We even now perhaps know where the spores are. And if we see PET signal outside of that, we can reliably conclude that the only way that got there was movement from the leaves through the roots and into the surrounding medium. So it is possible, and that's definitely something we are in the process of working on.
Yes.
Do you see any correlation between, like, is there any high nitrogen from a pulpa is helping to get the actinobacteria or transloading that nitrogen?
So we did. We,
the second part
yeah,
of
yes.
The question, do you have any species you found in actinobacteria, some species level, like the Streptomyces or Bacillus?
So the question was whether the alfalfa treatments, how they impacted soil or plant characteristics, and if there are any specific species that seem to be correlated with the alfalfa treatments. So we did measure soil and leaf tissue traits as well. So the alfalfa did increase soil nitrogen, and it also increased the leaf tissue nitrogen as well. And it didn't really significantly increase the yield, but the alfalfa with the biochar did have the highest average yield overall, though it was not different than the control. But we did see a reduction in fruit loss as well, so it's helping to mitigate some of that. As far as specific species, I'm not really sure. I haven't really looked at the species level to see which might be responsible. And it's hard to say that the microbes for sure, you know, are the cause of the higher nitrogen in the soil and the leaf tissue. I can only speculate that it's correlated, so it might have something to do with the microbiology. Yeah. Does that answer your question? Okay.
and biological processes. Obviously, these very expensive techniques and sample limited. I was wondering how you can address the problem of sample size, variability in terms of understanding actual processes that are going on. And then there's another problem you mentioned in terms of length of time to collect data. And I was wondering if some of the things that you're finding are in any way contradict what we have discovered about some of these processes from other approaches that may have used a number of different methods in order to obtain that.
Okay, so the question deals with this new this application of a new technology of X-ray imaging, which can be very expensive and time-consuming, both for setup as well as the scans. Is that showing us anything different or complementary or contradictory to previous or additional imaging technologies? The answer is we're just getting started. Again, for an example, the X-ray imaging often takes a very long time when you're looking at samples in soil because you need much more information to pull it out. If you recall the excavated maize root crowns, that's a very easy scan. That's 3 minutes. So that, in fact, is high throughput. So we can do that very readily. The other end of the spectrum is any sort of roots in a growing medium. The scans take longer. The data takes longer. The sample sizes are much smaller. We're using that, again, as a complementary technology, and that's some of the unique position we have at the Danforth Center. We have a really sophisticated conventional microscopy facility. So we have confocal, we have multiphoton, we can do a lot of split root and split pot studies. So these are always in collaboration with a number of other groups. So we're really mindful of linking what we're seeing both with the previous literature as well as what our colleagues are looking at. One of the funding sources we have is Valent Biosciences, and in fact they have a research center or research labs in the building next door to ours in a plant biology incubator system. And so we're literally working hand in hand with them. They are generating the cultures, they're inoculating the plants, and we're doing the scanning. So there's a great deal of crosstalk with these experts. And my expertise is not in mycorrhizal fungi, but it is in imaging and in plant biology. So we're hoping to use X-ray imaging in a variety of different ways. The X-ray microscope is the high res, small size, long scans. The larger scale instrument, we can scan very large pots much faster and get moderate throughput, in addition to the field work that they're doing and greenhouse work that they're doing. So there's multiple stages, all with the sort of background, how can we get close to a field situation? Like Rachel was saying, this is a very, very, often it's a very artificial system, but does that give us a predictive value? Does some of the structural changes that we see in root architecture with and without microbes, does that have predictive value to go to the field? And in fact, our lab put out a paper just in the past month using a gel imaging system where you can look at root growth in the first 15 days. That correlated very strongly with the excavated root crowns we saw at the end of the season. So there is predictive value. So prediction is a huge part of what we want to get into. Again, getting back to, can we measure traits and then use those measurements in breeding programs?
Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank the speakers. I invite everyone to stay, but right now we're going to be moving into the professional interest group meeting. So for those interested in root growth and rhizosphere, we're going to start planning for 2020. Those of you who want to speak to some of the speakers could go outside, unless the speakers want to stay and become part of our 2020 planning for the professional interest group. Thank you.